afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. It's really gascrisis.org. We've just changed it.
Yes, it's rapidly coming upon us.
Yeah. So it's actually We the People Radio, but I would encourage you go directly to the site that has all of the information about the looming gas crisis. I don't know if it's looming anymore. Gas at Costco yesterday was $4.05 here in Northern California. So
yeah, up from 3:30 something.
Yeah.
3:39.
So here we go.
We could go.
You should be stocking up on non-perishable stuff. But anyway, we have done three programs with these guys. Two, actually, with all of them. And then one last week, we did an hour with Mike regarding the refinery in Valero. So we will be speaking with Professor Michael Miché, Stan Ellis, who is an assemblyman and an oil and gas man, and he's the land man. I always call him the land man.
Nice.
Also runs a for heaven's sakes, not geophysics, it's the other thing. Come on, you guys, help me. Stan. Anyone?
Can't help.
Are they muted?
Oh,
quantum physics
quantum
lab.
Physics.
Thank you.
Yep. There you go.
I read it and it came right out of your mouth. Quantum physics lab. And then Mike Ariza, who spent 13 years running the Valero refinery and done a lot of other things. So he has a lot of refinery, on-the-ground refinery experience. And between the three of them, they have been sounding the alarm, I guess. We'll be pushing the panic button, I mean, really, at this point. So we have been doing multiple parts on this, and the media has been doing a really pretty good job, actually, of ignoring it, except for Katie Grimes and California Insider and a few of those, and I've got videos and things posted for you to take a look at. But if this doesn't kind of light your hair on fire, I guess, well, shoot.
Yeah.
You're not going to like anything else we do either.
You must own a moped.
Yeah, don't listen to any of the shows about wolves or China or any of that. You're not going to like those either. All right, guys, where do we begin this week? So it's, let's see, February 15th, 2026 is where we are at this point. We started this in December with you.
I think gas is probably as cheap as it's ever going to be right now.
And as available as it's ever going to be. So, who wants to lead the charge today?
Well, this is Stan, and I think Professor, if you could kind of give an overview. He was in the Capitol last week addressing several assembly members and senators. You might give an update on that, Professor, and then we can kind of dive in.
Oh, sure, I'd be happy to. And hello, Aaron, and everybody. Good to be back on with you all. So on Wednesday, the 18th, Stan was there and a few of us gave a briefing, to members of the legislature and their staffs. So here's our situation. We have lost both refineries. They are down and they are not coming back. That collectively between those refineries that went renewable and the two we lost, which would be Phillips 66 in Los Angeles and Valero in Venezia, we've lost 22% of our in-state gasoline refinery gallons of gasoline a day.
Wait, say that one more time. We've lost 22% and then it cut out after that.
Yeah, 22%. That's 10 million gallons a day of gasoline that is no longer being produced in the state of California.
10 million.
Okay. Six on the bottom side, 10 on the top side, 8 in between.
Oh,
all right.
Wow.
So depending on the product slate, because when you're making in a refinery, you're not just making gasoline. You're making jet fuel. You're making diesel fuel. You're making gasoline, and you're making distillates. All right. So depending on what you're making today, it varies. But that number that we've lost is a minimum of 6.2 million and over 10 million depending on the product mix of any one day. So this this is a major thing for California, because despite what the state may be telling you, and what I mean by that are the agencies such as the California Air Resource Board and the California Energy Commission, they've been on record as saying that EVs and California demand for gasoline is dropping at 2 to 4% a year and will accelerate precipitously through 2045 to almost minimal amounts. Well, that is entirely incorrect, and it's entirely misleading. Gasoline consumption has fallen in the state by less than 1% a year from 2001 through 2025. In fact, in 2025, gasoline consumption really didn't fall too much. It fell by less than 1%. We're still getting the final numbers on that. So we don't have this incredible drop in consumption that that some of these state agencies will tell you. It doesn't exist. So what that has created is now is a great imbalance between how much gasoline does California really have versus the demand. Now, don't forget, California provides 88% of the fuel to Nevada and about 38 to 43% of the fuel to Arizona. So not only do we supply ourselves, we supply two neighboring states. And so we have a contagion effect. What happens in California, good or bad, has a direct impact on both Nevada and Arizona. So bottom line, Northern California, the prices are going to go up considerably, particularly over the summer. I know they've gone up at least 10% over the last 2 weeks. We expect them to go up as much as anywhere from 53 cents to 15 by August in Northern California.
Do the numbers again.
Figure 53 cents to $1.15 in Northern California by the end of the year, certainly by August to the end of the year.
Okay.
All right. Now here's the problem. The state has no plan for this. This was completely avoidable. You could see it coming. The only plan the state has is live with it. We're going to import it. Foreign markets will make up for the imbalance of gasoline. Well, that's an interesting concept, and they will. What the state's not telling you is at what price will they make it up, that imbalance.
Yeah.
All right, so it creates a whole lot of other problems, because now we're running into port capacity issues, tanker issues. Tankers aren't chartered by the number of barrels of oil or gasoline that you put on the tanker. You charter a tanker by day, and the rates have tripled over the last 8 weeks, driving up the price of gasoline that's now coming into the state, along with jet fuel. So we're now increasing, or we have increased, our imports of gasoline and jet fuel to all-time historical highs. Never in the state of California have we had this level of importation of foreign-sourced fuel, and it's only going to get worse. So that's a little bit of what we went over in Sacramento on Wednesday.
And what was the, I'm always curious, what was the response? I mean, was this news to them? Were they aware, but, they were unable to do anything with it, or?
Well, I think you could put the response sort of like a classroom of students, where one third of them go, holy crap, we get it. Wow, didn't know it. Getting it, got to do something about it. The other third are like,
Bueller.
Yeah, frozen. Right? Frozen, like, holy smokes.
Oh,
and then a third are just completely in denial. You know, 2 and 2 do not equal 4 in their world. 3 and 3 do not equal 6. They're in just complete denial. So that's basically what we have. And no solutions were offered by anyone in the audience in terms of what California can do, except import more gasoline and buy more EVs.
So,
yeah, and by the way, let's do a vehicle mileage tax on top of it all, right?
Yeah. Yes, because that's absolutely what we should be working on.
Right. So you know why there's a vehicle mileage tax, right? So what happened back in 2015, 16, when all this stuff sort of began, there were a few of us that actually did projections, and they weren't really very precise, but they were more models. And we said, look, as the number of EVs increase on the road, holding road tax, the state excise tax, you know, static, unchanged, the total amount of revenue that the state will generate for road maintenance will decline. And that's a bit of an issue of tax equity and disproportionality. The reason it's tax equity is the person who's driving the internal combustion engine car, when they fill up their car, and at today's cost, it's 62 cents a gallon, the highest state excise tax in the country, 62 cents a gallon, they pay for that, and it goes to road maintenance and improvements and things like that. The person who's driving next to you on the 405 or the 5 in their EV in that lane next to you is paying zero in terms of road taxes. And so our model showed that as the number of EVs were adopted, that increased, receipts came down. And then a few years later, the state legislative office came out with a report saying, gee, we're going to be down by at least $5 billion by 2030 or 2032 if these EV adoption rates are correct. So the solution now is a mileage tax, which is quite interesting because at least one of the plans that I saw, it's kind of intrusive because they want you to report your mileage literally, through electronic means, which means they'll calculate the rate, the speed at which you were traveling, the distance at which you could travel, point A to point B, what route you took, what time of day you took that travel. So, I think one might have some issues with the amount of personal data that's being captured on that. But that's what happened with that.
And so they want you to self-report that?
Well, there's a couple of different ideas, I think. I'm not sure what they floated on. One was self-reporting, where you would take a picture of your odometer and your VIN number, and you send it into DMV, or you show up at a DMV office. That was one. A second is you show up and provide an affidavit. And a third is, there's a lot of, why don't we do it like we do for the toll roads? You can buy this device, you stick it into one of the chip receptors in your automobile, and it captures all this data. And then at the end of the year, it gets downloaded or somehow uploaded to the DMV, and they calculate the mileage tax and you pay it, which I believe you would probably pay on your vehicle motor registration, or they'll send you a bill separate for that.
And
but
they
hold your registration, I would presume, if you don't pay the tax.
Do they have a rate already established for that?
I saw something like around 3 cents a mile, something along those lines, 2.8 on up to like 5 cents a mile.
Yeah, and that doesn't sound
like
a lot.
But again, this is all hypothetical, right?
Yeah.
I haven't seen the definitive numbers yet. But I think an easier way is just saying, if you have an EV or you have a hybrid, this is the average miles that you get from a hybrid, or this is the average miles that an internal combustion engine gets. This is the average miles that you drive in California. Multiply that by 62 cents, and that gets added to your vehicle registration fees, and you're getting pretty close to equity. Right, because the EV driver would be paying it as I would be paying it as I buy gasoline based on average miles.
Because basically they're penalizing everybody that isn't driving an EV.
Correct. Yeah,
they want us to subsidize their EV use. It sounds to me like it would be better to tax the EV user, and everything should come out in the wash.
Well, it would be pretty close when you do that. In fact, it is a subsidy, right?
Sure.
You know, you've had federal subsidies put on the EV industry. Now they're removed. President Trump put those off effective October 1st. But then you have the state coming back in to try to subsidize the industry. But the average person who's driving a 10-year-old car because it's paid for, and they're happy that it's paid for, servicing them quite, adequately, they're subsidizing the person driving the $8,500 Tesla.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that are really heavy and breaking down the roads. And so...
Yeah. Well, they are much heavier. I think one state... We charge vehicle registration on the value of the car. We'd all love to see how that algorithm is determined. But I think other states do it on the weight of the vehicle because it makes far more sense, right? Because a heavier vehicle does put more wear and tear on the surface and substructure of the road. That's why trucks pay more taxes.
Okay? Sure.
They wear and tear the road because they weigh more. So I think if you were looking for true tax equity, you would do so based on average miles and then weight of the vehicle rather than the value.
Wow. Okay, so before
you think about it, right? When you think about it on the value, right? You're already paying for that value in the state sales tax.
Yep.
Right.
So, you know,
and your gas tax and your
tax. Yeah. So again, I think this is just another clever way of deriving additional revenue for the state and subsidizing the EV movement.
Well, and let's not forget making more bureaucracy, because we'll of course need more people to run that program, and the king up at the top of the hill has pulled up the moat, and he's got a lot more guys and. Their food is fancy, the clothes are nice, and the people at the bottom can pretty much just suck it.
Yep.
That's kind of how it turns out. That's how it's turned out throughout history.
That is one way of looking at it.
Yeah, I mean, that's historically how it worked out, right? You had a guy with a sword, he was kind of a good guy, and then ultimately he becomes the king, and pretty soon he marries his sister, he's a hemophiliac, nobody sees him anymore, he can't lift the sword. Well, yes, now we have modern civilization. So, we do have to take a quick break. Before we do it, Professor, give us the number again. We had how many refineries, now we have how many? Let's be clear on the numbers.
We had over 40 about 30 years ago. We had over 40 refineries 30 years ago, and now we are down to 7.
Right. And we just lost 2.
Well, we had 9 and we lost 2.
And we lost 2.
We're sitting at 7. Yeah, we're sitting at 7 today.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just to be clear. All right.
And potentially losing 4.
And we're going to come back with more bad news right after this break. when we hear from Stan and Mike. So, you are listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Yeah, between Another One Bites the Dust and lots of songs about walking, I figure we got a theme going for today. And I just wanted to let people know we have pulled all this together under one domain, all the different shows, all the links that these guys are sending. I put them all together under gascrisis.org. Easy to send. You can text it to people. It's got kind of a good little graphic that comes up with it. And I would get people plugged in on this because Yeah, that's the only way you're going to get these guys to move is if there's quite a bit of public pressure. You're going to see people at the gas station that are mad, but do they really know why? Do they know why it's happening? It's not the big, beautiful bill, which is what we blame for everything.
It's the oil companies taking profits.
That's right. Yeah, forgot about that. We were supposed to blame the oil companies. Gosh, I keep missing the mark on that one. Don't we also have some of the plants going down for maintenance here soon or now?
Yes, we do. We have, this is Professor Mache again, so we have PBF. They've already gone public with their maintenance schedule. They have a maintenance plan for the first quarter, which we're in the midstream of the first quarter of 2026. So they have maintenance planned now for one of their facilities. And then they have a second maintenance for the second quarter planned for their other facility. So
when we hear that, we're thinking, you know, a major housekeeping effort or whatever, but that's not what that means. That means shutdown.
It means shutdown or partial shutdown, depending on what they're doing. So these are maintenance. They're not turnarounds, but nonetheless, there are shutdowns associated with it. They're not nearly as long, but they're not. Point is, it's reduced production.
Yeah, and for how long, ballpark?
Could be anywhere from 2 to 6 weeks, depending on what they're working on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Depends on what they're working on and what they find. If they find any problems that they have to fix, because every now and then that happens, they find unexpected issues and a startup is delayed because of that.
And we have what type of a reserve? How about that? How long can things be offline before it hits the ground?
Well. Gasoline reserves are a little different than crude reserves, okay? Crude reserves, we have around, maybe 16 days supply. And it's almost a continuous input because, you know, worst comes to worst, we still have crude production in the state of California. The problem that we have is gasoline, it doesn't store real well, okay? So, all the people that are farmers, know that, okay? You have gasoline goes bad. And we only have maybe 14 to 15 days supply. And what I call that a running supply because it's not sitting around literally in a tank. It may be in a tank, but it's not going to be there for more than just a few days. It runs through. So what happens is when the production numbers indicate a fall in supply, and that's supply would include the storage or inventory. And when that number falls below 14, prices begin to creep up. When it hits 12 or 12 and a half, it's a hockey stick type thing. They shoot up, straight up, by at least a dollar a gallon. And that's just the way the industry works. Looking to store it, you know, was one idea from ABX 2-1. But that's really a bad idea because it adds 7 cents to the price of gas all year long, and the gasoline is going to have to be turned over anyway. There aren't enough storage facilities in the state for that type of storage anyway. And then you have to ask yourself, do the producers want to incur the cost of storage? And they don't. It's at least $35 million per tank. And they're not going to incur that cost.
No, you can't blame them. I mean,
no.
They're already being hammered everywhere else, and then to add that on top of it makes it tough to make a profit.
Yeah. I mean, these are businesses. So that's
and let's not forget that soon after ABX 2-1 was passed, I think it was within 72 hours that Phillips 66 announced they were leaving the state. So we can sit here and hammer the bad refiners, but there's a correlation and there is causality to these policies, right?
Absolutely.
So prices are highly correlated to the policies and some of the business decisions just follow those along. These are routine business decisions and for whatever the reasons are, I don't know what they are, but somehow in the state of California at the policy level, either they didn't get it when they went to college or something along those lines, but companies have a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders. And in that sense, they must allocate their capital in the most prudent ways that provide for the return to their shareholders. And so when you're looking at California, those opportunities just simply cease to exist at this point.
Okay.
Well, I remember the last time you were on, you were talking about the special blend that comes in during the summer, and that should hit in April. Is that correct?
Well, we have a special blend period, all right? But there are two seasonal blends. There's a winter blend and there's a summer blend, right? And there's a reason for that, because of atmospheric conditions, and you're trying to get the particulate counts lower and the carbon emissions lower and things like that. So there are two seasons, winter and summer. Because of California's climate, our summer starts earlier and our winter starts later. Now, summer gasolines require more refinement. Therefore, the costs are higher, and the prices drift up anyway. But now with the loss of two refineries, they're really going to drift up. So that's what we're looking at.
Okay.
Yeah, during the summer, the refineries, butane is produced along with propane in the conversion or cracking process, and during the winter, that butane, which has a higher vapor pressure, is you're allowed to blend that in with the total gasoline pool. During the summer, that butane is actually removed from the total gasoline pool. I remember actually cutting the refinery back a little bit at Valero a couple of times because we had so many butane rail cars that we were having trouble getting them all out. We had no place to put the butane and we couldn't flare it. So that's... But like Professor said, the refinery going down, PBF, one going down for turnaround, another one going down for turnaround the next quarter, summer blend kicking in. And with Valero down, you have to almost laugh at some of these publications or press releases. You know, the state government had Valero come to the Capitol and maybe a month and a half ago and tried to, basically, I call it a bribe. And, you know, give them $200 million. I forget the amount now. You know, hey, we'll give you a couple hundred million if you guys can stay open. And Valero basically told them to get lost. We're shutting down. As the professor has pointed out, taking a $1.1 billion loss to just get out of the state. So, when the state sits there and says, well, we're working with them to ensure supplies, I think that is just bogus. I don't think they're doing it. You lost on Valero on an average day because it makes mostly gasoline. It makes what jet fuel and diesel it can naturally distill out of the crude oil, which is another reason why even red dye crude oil now is going up here, and farmers are getting hammered up here in Northern California. But Valero on an average day makes 4.3 to 4.7 million gallons a day of gasoline. So that's all gone. And in our discussions that we all had, we're looking at, you know, the ports and their ability to bring in tankers and offload tankers is near capacity, and that was before Valero went down. And you got to go back to 2023. That's when the attack on gasoline, jet, and all that really started, when the Phillips Refinery Rodeo and the Marathon Martinez were converted to renewable diesel. That was 350,000 barrels a day of crude oil processing that went offline. That means all the gasoline, jet fuel, and propane that those refineries ran offline. So we were already short back in 2023. And then here's another, you know, Phillips and Wilmington went down. That's another 8 to 10%. Valero, a solid 10 to 12% of gasoline. Valero, we also just lost 700,000 roughly gallons a day of jet fuel and diesel, give or take 100,000 either way. Travis is supplied by Valero. That's offline. And before Valero actually went down, we were very concerned about the infrastructure being able to offload tankers at the ports before Valero went offline. Now they went offline. So we're in a bind.
Well, and just so people don't miss this, if they haven't been following this with our programs, the oil and gas that came out, the gas and the jet fuel that came out of Valero, much of that was delivered by pipeline. mean, that jet fuel went from Valero to Travis Air Force Base, not in trucks. So it isn't like, oh, well, we'll just bring it in a tanker and put it in the trucks that they were using before. That isn't how it got
there. Yeah, it's all pipeline.
Yeah.
It's all pipeline. I like the professor was saying about gasoline, too. It doesn't sit there. You know, we have one channel at Valero, one radio channel, which was really unusual, but you got to listen to a lot of things you normally wouldn't hear in other refineries. And I would always hear, you know, they got a premium tank ready. They pull samples on it, you know, regular unleaded jet fuel, whatever the case may be. Those tanks don't sit there. They fill up the refinery. They pump them out to Concord, Kinder Morgan, or Brisbane. And then they send it off to the final destination. But the tanks, it's like the professor was saying, gasoline doesn't hold up. And at the refinery, they don't sit there. They fill those tanks. They sample those tanks. When those tanks sample good, maybe 6 hours later, that tank is pumped out.
Oh, wow.
What's the lifespan of gasoline? Once it's produced and goes into a tank, I was told that 30 days is when it starts to turn and kind of goes sour after that. Is that true?
Yeah, that's about right. It actually begins souring just a few days shorter than that. And what happens, it's a degradation of the chemical content, the molecular content in gasoline. So what will happen is the longer it sits, the less combustible it becomes. So it loses combustibility factors, and it actually turns into varnish.
Right.
So if you have gasoline sitting, you know, in tanks for prolonged periods of time, it loses a lot, and it will turn into varnish. Which, as I said, a lot of farmers, you know, have figured that out, because particularly where I grew up in the cold weather climate, you know, you're done farming in October. And then you're not moving again until, you know, March. So if you're not cleaning your tanks out, you're going to have a problem getting them started again. So, and anybody that collects cars knows that too. So, it loses its quality. So it's not like crude oil. Crude oil has been in the ground for millions and millions and millions of years. You take it out of the ground, you put it in a tank, it's the same crude oil. Gasoline's not like that. It's a finished product. It has significant value attached to it. So asking these refiners to build hundreds of, you know, millions of gallons of gasoline for storage is ludicrous.
Yeah.
Keep this in mind, right? California burns about 35 million gallons of gasoline a day. Okay? Now the state is asking them to keep something like 16 days supply.
Oh, wow.
That's 560 million gallons of gasoline.
Yeah.
All right? Now multiply that times the wholesale cost.
Yeah.
It's $1 billion. It's $1 billion extra.
That you're just going to have sitting there.
That you're going to have sitting there in inventory. Now, you have to recover that somehow, right?
Well, unless you want to go, like everybody else, leave the state and go do business someplace else.
Yeah, unless you want to go out of business, right, you're going to have to recover it. So just simply take, you know, take a ridiculous amount of product and, you know, just off the back of the napkin.
Yeah.
And put it on hold. And then build all of these tanks. Where do you build all these tanks? Where do you put them? There's no property around the refinery.
So you're adding about 7 cents to the gallon of gas year round to cover that inventory cost.
And we haven't built the tanks yet to store it.
That's right. It doesn't cover building the tanks, which is another at least $1.2 billion, because you got to buy the tanks, you got to build the tanks, you got to put in the infrastructure,
yeah,
all the pipe structure. Now, keep in mind, gasoline storage is different than oil. Yes, oil is flammable, but it's not like gasoline. Gasoline is highly flammable, highly volatile, right?
Yep.
You need a completely different storage infrastructure for that, different valves, different safety mechanisms, different vaporing, okay?
Well, and the part we left out was you're going to have couldn't even, I mean, this is an unknowable number for lawsuits from environmental groups. So just like piled out piled out on the top, right?
Yeah.
It's going to make the storage fees look like child's play.
Everything, getting permits for all that, like the professor saying,
where are you going to build it?
Yeah, we're not young. Right. We'll never see it happen.
As Mike has said, where are you going to build it, right?
Yeah.
And then, by the way, let's just suppose somehow somebody could agree that you could have a strategic tank farm out in the middle of nowhere, California, right?
Okay.
Let's just suppose that. Well, how are you going to get the product there, and how are you going to get it out? You're going to need a pipeline.
And then
I'll try to get a pipeline built in California.
Then you'll need another zillion dollars for those lawsuits. And tons. And even if you didn't have any of that, the time it would take to make that happen. I mean, for God's sake, we've been screwing around with high cost rail for, you know, almost two decades and haven't laid, you know, an inch of track. So the odds of us being saved by the pipeline.
Pretty slim. And there's no way you're going to move that volume of product by truck
over the road.
Yeah,
right.
That's just not even an option.
Yeah, we'll all have to stay home because there won't be room on the road. We have to take a quick break. Imagine
it
comes so quickly.
The Chinese hear the horse.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's all about what we can make everyone do, right? All righty. We'll be right back. We're speaking with Professor Michael Miché, Mike Ariza, and also Stan Ellis from the and we don't blame him for this. He's just there temporarily. This is not his life's ambition to be in the California State Assembly. He's trapped there now. We'll give him an out because I feel bad for you there. It's got to be frustrating as I'll get out. How about that? You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Compliance. We just need your compliance. You will feel no pain anymore. No more defiance. We just need your compliance. Give us your compliance. We won't let you feel lost anymore. No more self-reliance.
Oh, yes. Yes. That's the answer.
Yep. Got an answer for everything. Who would have thought? Queen, the prophets, right? Fat bottom girls. Oh, my God. This stuff makes me feel a little silly inside. I think it's the anger. All right. So, for people that are just plugging into this issue, what else do they need to know, Stan? Let's go to you since I botched your intro with the quantum physics lab.
You didn't botch my intro, I wanted to, as I'm listening to you guys, I want to really first of all thank you from the bottom of my heart to bring this matter to the public, because a lot of people aren't hearing this. And then the other thing I want to do is commend Mike Ariza and Professor. And we never knew each other before this happened. About 6 months ago we met, and we've actually become really good personal friends. So for every bad, there's some good.
Of course.
but thank you guys. But I want to tell you that this administration has botched their greenhouse gas agenda from its inception without forward thinking. When you're going to take and try to go all electric by a certain year, wouldn't you think that there was some sort of answer to the energy availability? And you look right now, there's electric manufacturers have written off in this country $100 billion in their electrical vehicle infrastructure to big companies. And so the answer should have been, if you're going to go electric, then you better have electric power to back it up.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, it's real simple, right? So we spend $1 billion on a year on a cap and trade on high speed rail. And we could have been putting that into fusion and other. I'm a science guy. I've been in the oil and gas industry for 50 years. I've been in chemical process for most of that and quantum physics for about 14. I'm the science guy. The greenhouse gas agenda and the electric greenies have driven our state into crisis. And yet that nobody will admit it. And nobody will give us a solution. Oh, their solution is to import more gas and diesel. Well, what have they done? They've jeopardized. The professor said it best. We have oil and gas, and the energy sector is 8% of our GDP, but it's the first 8%. If we can't deliver, if we can't get diesel to farm our produce, if we can't get our products to the grocery stores, how are we going to survive? If we have a conflict now in the Pacific somewhere, we are in crisis mode not only with the public, we are in crisis with our military, of 42 bases we have in California for jet fuel.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
So the solution, their solution is to import more. Here's the solution. The solution is to federalize oil and gas in California, so we become energy independent, like we are in the rest of the country, and we slap our hands around CARB, and we say, okay, no more. You can go to 99.99% efficiency for X, but when you go to 99.9999% lower emissions, that costs you hundreds of billions of dollars, and it's uneconomical.
Well, and it's unintelligent. Yeah. I mean, it makes no difference. Does it make any difference? Maybe I should ask it rather than say it. Will anyone know?
People are not listening.
But is this the tree falls in the forest thing? No, this percentage that they're after, you know, this perfection that they're chasing.
That's a greenhouse, greeny, environmental group agenda.
Right.
And yeah, it's nice. We all want clean air. We all want clean water. We all want a clean environment. But at what cost? At some point, there is common sense has to kick in, and you can have a little pollution with some economics. But they crossed that line way years ago when they wanted to go all electric. They screwed us all.
Yeah.
Yep. let me ask this. So as far as gasoline and jet fuel production and delivery, at what point will the production of jet fuel become more important than the production of gasoline and create like huge shortages in California? Do you see that coming?
Well, yeah, Go ahead, Mike.
No, please, you go ahead.
No, you.
With jet, you know, you lost Valero. With the many talks that we have, you know, me and the professor and Stan, you know, it's like when El Segundo had its fire and their jet hydrofiner went offline, they lost some of the gasoline production units. Those came back quickly, but the fire, the jet hydrofiner was down for quite a while. So they had to divert, the professor was saying they diverted from the Gulf Coast 460,000 barrels of jet fuel to Southern California, and they also diverted jet fuel that's produced in Northern California down to Southern California because obviously it was creating such a severe shortage down there from that refinery being down because it's so big. So now that Northern California jet fuel dropped off by well over a third because Valero's down. it's not there. And Valero also supplied Travis. So if you have something similar, we'll have a it's not inconceivable to see that we will have a severe jet fuel shortage that will affect all of our airports, SFO-LAX, and definitely affect our military. I think it's already affecting our military right now, but you can't get numbers and stuff like that on the military because it's classified. But the fact that 700,000 gallons a day, give or take, went offline, and it's offline permanently here in Northern California, they have to be looking at this from a shortage standpoint. But yeah. But the fire, that's another problem. We lose another refinery. You know, like, see, El Segundo goes down again. Valero was running. It was supplying jet fuel, diesel, propane, 4.5 million gallons a day of gasoline. Now it's gone. It's down.
Mm-hmm. So do you see them prioritizing the jet fuel over gasoline and kind of just...
Can they even do that?
Yeah, can they do that and just let the public swing?
I think you got to reason it out. Mm-hmm. Right? So think of it like this, right? The fastest growing segment of fuels in California are jet fuels right now. So jet fuel began growing in terms of number of gallons or barrels consumed, began accelerating around 2020, 2021, took a dive during COVID, and then came springing right back. So you have FIFA, which is the Soccer World Cup, and also the Olympics coming to California. That will precipitate a demand in jet fuels as well. So what will happen is the California refineries will be forced into making an economic decision. Do I want to make more gasoline or do I want to make more jet fuel? Now, part of that decision is going to be based on the cost of production. If it's less expensive for that refinery to make jet fuel and the profit margin's higher than gasoline, they're going to convert or divert their production capabilities to jet fuel, which means California will be importing even more gasoline from foreign sources, predominantly South Korea and China and perhaps Singapore. Now, the irony from South Korea is that 20% to 30% of the oil that's used to build gasoline or make gasoline that will be imported from California comes from the United States. So it's kind of interesting, the dilemma that we're in. The other part of this is if indeed there's a national emergency or a national event, then it'll be a very simple mandate from Washington, D.C., saying you will make diesel fuels and you will make jet fuel in lieu of gasoline, and we will ration gasoline in the state of California. I just reviewed that this morning, as a matter of fact, in 1941, 1942, under the Roosevelt administration, you had scripts called A, B, and C. And depending on what letter you were, you got 3 gallons of gasoline a week, or you got 4 gallons of gasoline a week, or you got 6 gallons of gasoline a week. And that's what occurred during World War II. So that is an easy solution for the federal government. They can just come in and just say, you will make more jet fuel. So that'll have a significant impact on prices for the California consumer as well. But I think Stan brought up, you know, a really cogent point here. This whole thing started 2017, 2018 under Jerry Brown, and then really accelerated under Gavin Newsom on terms of 2035 being a date for carbon neutral type things. And the problem with that is there's no real math or no real science, no real economics behind that date. That was relatively an arbitrarily determined date that the governor apparently picked and signed it through an executive order. And that was the first real significant blow to the refinery industry. They've just told people that have $1 billion invested, $15 billion invested in the state for a refinery, that I'm taking away your market.
They were getting ready to kneecap them. And
yeah, so why would I stay here?
Yeah.
Under what theory of lunacy would I stay in California to do the business?
Okay, fellers, we're hitting the news. But we're going to come back, and we're going to chat about this some more. So I do believe at the beginning of the hour, don't miss that song, because I have one. I have a special one for Gavin Newsom and his friends. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Well, if I had money, I'd tell you what I'd do. I'd go downtown, buy a Mercury or two. I'm crazy about a Mercury. Lord, I'm crazy about a Mercury. I'm gonna buy me a Mercury and cruise it up and down the road. I'm gonna buy me a Mercury and cruise it up and down the road. Yeah, I'm gonna buy me a Mercury and cruise it up and down the road.
To see somebody try
and make me.
Anyone who wants to try
and make me
turn into a man. Catch me if you can.
I won't grow up.
I won't grow up. I will never even try.
I will never even try.
I will do what Peter tells me.
I will do what Peter tells me.
And I'll never ask him why.
And I'll never ask him why.
We won't grow up.
We won't grow up.
We will never grow a day.
We will never grow a day.
And if someone tries to make us.
And if someone tries to make us.
We will simply run away.
We will simply run away.
Yes, well, that was a sneak preview into Gavin Newsom's meeting about the oil and gas problem. I'm pretty sure that's what they play in the background, because there seems to be a no adult supervision in the room. You have rejoined We the People Radio for the second hour. Bill didn't like the Peter Pan song. He has a scowl on his face. He has a scowl for radio.
I'm not big on Disney either.
Oh, but you know what? It's just so ludicrous. Honestly, it's just crazy. So, we have Mike Ariza, Assemblyman Stan Ellis, and Professor Michael Miche. I thought if I did it in a different order, I would do a better job with us today. You can follow their interviews, not just on our program, but the ones with California Insider. Katie Grimes has been doing quite a bit on this. So articles and things about the impending gas shortage and the refineries going down and all of that. You should really get informed, and now would be a good time to do that. You can find it at gascrisis.org. It sends you to the radio page, but that's easier to remember. So if you use gascrisis.org and shoot it to some other folks, they can get on there. You can read, you can listen, you can watch. So whatever you like to do, there's something there for you on this topic. All right, men, we're back. Back to the grind. What would we like to hit this hour? I know, Professor, you were in the midst of something in the news got in our way.
Oh, no. I was going to say, you know, it's just incredible when you think about you're trying to manipulate 39 million people into buying a product which most of them don't want to have and can't afford.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, that in itself, and that's not conjecture on my part. Those are, you know, that's Gavin Newsom's stated position, to use the market power and the legislative force of California to address climate change. And the method he wants to use is increase these gasoline prices to an intolerable level to force people out of internal combustion cars into EVs, when in fact the market is showing unequivocally they're not that interested in owning EVs. Of course, sales went up before the subsidies ran out. So sales went up considerably in August and September. September had a huge run up. The subsidies went out in October, and sales have come crashing down. And they're probably going to stay at that level. And the interesting aspect of that is that, you know, Governor Newsom has said, well, let's allocate $200 million as subsidies for EV sales for California. Well, the state's already $1.6 trillion in debt, so I guess another $200 million doesn't really matter. But the point is that the people that buy EVs are higher income individuals. the data shows this, and the preponderance of registrations in California are along the coast, and they're in places like, you know, Atherton and Belvedere and Brentwood and Beverly Hills, you know, Montecito, really the high affluent areas. And so the people that probably don't need the subsidy are the ones who are buying the EVs. So it would seem to me if you're going to provide a subsidy and you want people to buy EVs, do it for lower income individuals under below, say, $125,000. But for some reason, the state hasn't gotten to that level of sophistication yet, or awareness.
We also don't have the grid capacity to handle the level of EV conversion that they are, you know, in their childish, you know, mathematics that they've come up with. We can't even support that.
Oh, it's somewhat hilarious, right? If you think those of us who were around back in the Gray Davis days when we had these massive brownouts and blackouts occurring in California in 2000, 2001, if you think that's bad, imagine if you had 19 million EVs plug in tonight at 7 o'clock at night. What do you think is going to happen to the grid?
Yeah, exactly.
Grid's down. Yeah, grid's offline.
It's just going to come down.
So for all the people who think, oh, well, you know, maybe they have the ability to do that, just, you know, run out and buy an EV. Well, I guess if gas gets too high, I'll just run out and do that. Well, we just created another problem.
Yeah.
It's also
a big-time problem. Right?
Yeah.
So you know, it comes to the point where we get, is there a... It's called point of diminishing marginal returns, right? So we're at a point of diminishing returns. Go ahead and pass legislation, but what are you really getting out of it, other than additional hardship and cost for the average hardworking California consumer? They can't afford it, right? So think about this, right? California produces less than 1% of total greenhouse emissions. That's the 1%.
Yeah.
So what is California truly accomplishing by forcing consumers to change their behavior and by imposing these draconian costs on the consumer?
Well, Professor, Professor just made a great comment. I was standing by to make the comment that if you take where we're getting our crude oil and our gas and all of those refineries that are polluting, and China's polluting, they have no environmental standards whatsoever, and we're getting 40% of our gas and diesel from India, and they have no environmental standards. I've worked in several countries around the world in chemical process. I promise you, they have nothing compared to California. We put out the cleanest gas and oil in the world. So thanks for bringing that up, Professor.
Oh, no. I mean, we do have the most stringent standards and the best production standards in the world here in California. Plus, we're sitting on the fifth largest reserves in the United States in California. At one time, California was the world's number one producer and exporter of oil. Granted, it was a long time ago, but we were number one. Today, we are the most heavily dependent of all 50 states on foreign-based oil. It just simply is incomprehensible why someone would think this is a good policy, given the fact that you got a $1.6 trillion debt. Unbelievable.
Yeah, and in those terms, too, like you're saying, we're also the most dependent state on imported fuels by far. And the one thing that really frustrates me is they keep hearing about how, well, we got control of this. And it's like, no, sir, you do not have control of storms that can delay ships. You don't have control of refineries going down unexpectedly. You don't have control of different situations in the world that could occur to cause us to have shortages of jet gasoline and diesel. You don't have control of so many things, you know, like the ship that caught fire at the dock at the Port of Los Angeles. You don't have control of these things. The governor's totally disingenuous when he looks at us and says, yeah, well, you know, we got this handled. No, you don't. You can't control these things. And we are now 42-44% of our gasoline's being imported. The vulnerability, us and the military, are at. And the thing is back in the 70s, once the crude oil resumed, we had, like in California, we had 40 or 41 refineries. Refineries came back up, and the country got itself back out, you know, the problem that it was in. But, you know, you're sitting there saying, we get into a shortage. If we get into a moderate shortage, or God forbid, a severe shortage, we do not have the refineries to pull us out of it. So we, there's, you know, there's a more than reasonable chance we will see severe civil unrest in all of our metropolitan areas. As the professor pointed out, Reno, Las Vegas, Phoenix, same thing there. Same thing with the prices, same thing with the shortages. And in California, we do not have the ability to get ourselves out of it. We cannot increase crude oil to refineries that don't exist and refine our way out of it. That's the problem we're in. That's the serious danger. That's the real danger that we're in. And we have to have presidential intervention, like Stan was saying. We have to have federal intervention where federal EPA takes over CARB and then works with refiners like Valero and others and see, you know, to determine what can we do to keep you open and get you back online. Because right now we're in serious danger.
Well, if you're a refinery and let's say the administration comes in and does make those change, you know, let's say they do make those changes, right? And it does make a difference. Well, the spooky part is, let's say the refinery says, okay, whew, you know, we no longer have the gun to our head. We can produce. Sure, we'll keep doing that. Well, in a few years, that can all change again, and they're right back where they started. Is there any kind of?
I think that's the fear.
Yeah,
and here's the other thing. I'm not at liberty to say, but I've seen someone's cap and trade charges a refinery in the state of California, and it's escalated, and one of them, I think this next year, was $140 million or $133 million for just cap and trade.
And so, Stan, explain for people who hear that thrown around a lot, what exactly, explain how stupid that really is.
Yeah, so cap and trade was, I don't know how many years ago they came up with the idea, but they wanted to charge for people that put out emissions. So when you burn natural gas in these refineries, what happens as coming out the stack, you have what's called carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, nitric oxide, some sulfur compounds, and others, okay? So they take and their molecular compounds, but they have weight. So they measure those in weight and tons per year. So when you put out so many tons per year, you have to pay into the state of California for putting out that many tons. So the more you refine, or the more you make cement, or the more you make any other, all the boilers and oil and gas, and they do steam injection, they use boilers. Everywhere that you have energy consumed and you have an emission, guess what? You get charged for it. And that's the problem that I have with California. And that's why these refiners cannot stay in business. You cannot pay over $100 million a year for cap and trade. They talk about oil and the gas companies and getting rich. No, they're not. They're going broke, and that's why they're leaving California.
So, okay, Stan, you're a refinery now, and and the Trump administration comes in and says, hey, look, we're gonna need to, you know, kind of lay a federal hand on this thing and stop this. California Air Resources Board and all the rest of this craziness, because we really need you guys to produce, you know, jet fuel and gas and whatever all else you're making. And so we're going to make that stop. Does it pencil for you to say, okay, I'll do it, knowing that potentially goes away in 3 years?
No. If you said it's going away in 3 years, and that's why we have to have legislation, actually, we have to have state legislation, which is going to be probably impossible because of the green agenda, and federal, but you're absolutely right. It helps short term if some people that have already made the investment want to stay, but people that have already gone, there's no reason to come back and spend $500 million starting in Valero when you can't advertise that over 3 years and make any money.
Yeah. And you don't have the ability.
You lose the ability to restart it, even if you wanted to, because all of the qualified people that can restart that refinery are gone.
Yeah, they moved.
Exactly.
They moved. They're not coming back. So
you think about it. If you're in your 40s or 50s and you're offered a transfer to Louisiana or Texas and you're making the same salary or more, and you're going to be able to keep your years that you've been working for the company, because they offered a lot of people transfers. I mean, if I was 45 and still working for them, I'd be gone. I wouldn't even think twice about it. Goodbye.
Yeah. So that makes no sense. What do you guys, just from your vantage points, do you think this precipitates a major, do you think this pushes voters in the state of California to reevaluate the direction that the folks they're sending to Sacramento are headed?
You kind of took the words out of my mouth. I was going to say that we have to get a lot worse so we can eventually get some red folks in, but it's not going to happen until the truth is out there where gas is $10 a gallon and there's gas lines. And then guess what they're going to do? They're going to blame Trump.
Right.
Because that's what the Democrats do. Everything that comes down the pike, they blame Trump instead of blaming themselves. So I'm frankly not very optimistic. We need to get some Republicans voted in so we don't have a super minority, so we can at least stop some of this legislation.
Yeah, because just for people who don't live in the state, you know, the ability for you in the assembly to make change is zero, but explain to them why.
So there in the assembly in the state of California, there are 80 assembly members that represent, you know, what, 40 million people. We all represent about a half a million. I represent a half a million people. And so then out of the 80, there are 20 Republicans and 60 Democrats. On the Senate side, there are 30, and of which 10 are Democrats and 20, I'm sorry, 20 are Democrats and 10 are Republicans. So no matter what we do, no matter what we vote on, it doesn't matter. Our vote does not count. So what we have to do is we have to increase the assembly, I think, by 6 or 10 more to at least be able to stop all this ridiculous legislation. And we got to have like 3 or 4 more on the Senate side.
Okay, so stick with the politics. And in November, we have a gubernatorial election, and you know, we have the you know, brain trust of Katie, what's her face, who screams at everybody, and Eric Swalwell. We'll leave out all the Fang Fang jokes, but so. We've got some bad choices on that side. We've got a couple of good Republican choices, and frankly, I don't care which one. Pick one. Pick who can win.
Yep.
Do that.
Right.
So
that's
let's
right.
say we elect a Republican governor.
At least he has veto power.
Yeah. So now we veto everything, but what's the ability to impact the agencies? Because that's executive branch.
That's a good question. If you're going to try to do it legislatively, we still need to put forth some legislation, and it could still get voted down.
Right.
So I don't have much faith that we're going to be able to do much, even if we had a Republican governor. But at least we'd have veto power, and it's critical that we stop some of the nonsense. That's the first thing. Stop the nonsense.
Yeah.
And then start. Then when you stop the nonsense and you have a Democrat, a Republican governor, then you're going to be able to elect more Republican legislators.
Yeah. Let's ruminate on that, and we will come right back. We have to take a swift break. So let's see. You're listening to We the People. You can find all the stuff about this oil and gas thing at gascrisis.com. .org.
Oh.
Gotcha.
average man with an average life. I work from 9 to 5. Hey, hell, I pay the price. All I want is to be left alone in my average home. But why do I always feel like I'm in the twilight zone? And I always feel like somebody's watching me. And I love the props. Oh, I always feel like somebody's watching me.
Because they are.
Guaranteed.
Because they're watching you.
Yes.
They want to watch you a lot more, too, given a choice. So, I remember when they came up with their 17% renewable power mandate, which sounded so magical. But
it's totally worked so far.
It's super worked so far. So we interviewed Jesus Arredondo, who was an energy policy, probably still is, energy policy attorney. Nice guy, super smart. He happened to be sitting in the meeting. And he said, hey, you want to know how they came up with that? We were like, okay, no, yes, we do, I guess. And he said, well, the first idea was 15%, but they thought that sounded too low. So then it was, how about 20? And he's kind of looking around, and there's no chart, there are no papers, no presentation, no slideshow, no nothing. And he's like, so then they, 20, but 20's kind of high, and they're kicking it around. And then, how about 17? Yeah, 17. 17
is on. Is that suspect?
Yeah, 17 sounds like a lot, but it's not. It's not unachievable. And he's like, wait. What are you guys basing this on? How are we going to get there? And they turned on him like a pack of dogs. And,
it's a Q-proof.
And they said, they turned on him like a pack of dogs and said, we haven't figured that out yet. We're coming up with the goal first.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, so, Stan, that's the way it works in science, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly. I want to give you an example.
Please do.
I'm on the assembly floor. Someone passes a bill to outlaw Teflon pans in California. So it came to a vote, and I stood up. I don't speak very often because I like to state of my science background. So I said, first of all, there are about 12,000 different chlorine and fluoride bonds, and you haven't done any acid chloride leaching on this material, so therefore it's non-leachable because I did the research. And so in your stomach, it acts like something that's inert and goes completely through you. Why do you want to outlaw Teflon pans when it's not hazardous? It's because somebody had this idea, just like you exactly quoted, that, 15% is a good number. Let's get the goal before we do the science. They didn't even do the science. It's all about putting forth ideas that have no data that backs them up, that just makes them look good to their constituents so they'll get elected. It's that simple.
So in this case, you can trust the science, right?
Exactly. Trust us. But they didn't even listen to the science. That's the bad part.
They didn't know what you were saying, actually. I don't think they actually understood it, right?
Well, and then, so let's come out to greenhouse gas, okay, and the greenhouse agenda. You know, through paleontology, you can determine global warming over the years and how much methane and ethane and our constituents by taking core samples of some of these glaciers. We've actually had some cooling trends, but they won't study the cooling trends. They only study the heating trends for their own agenda. We've had some summers that whole thing about greenhouse agenda is politically motivated. The science behind it is so back and forth, it's ridiculous.
Well, and if you disagree, you're basically a heretic, and then you get marginalized and kicked out of your whatever your industry is, whether it's science or politics or teaching or whatever your deal is. Well, look at the guy that started Greenpeace, Dr. Patrick Moore. We interviewed him a long time ago, and I was dying to know, like, why'd you leave, right? So I figured, he was tired of dealing with idiots, but he was actually better than that. He left because after they did the Save the Whales project, which apparently was based on science and was a pretty good deal, so they got done with that, and the people at Greenpeace, none of whom were scientists except for him, decided they were going to ban chlorine. And he was like, you can't ban chlorine because it's an element. And he he confirmed what we knew, that they had no idea, you know, what was on the periodic table or the fact that you can't ban a naturally occurring element. And so, Stan, I think you and Dr. Patrick Moore might want to spend some time together.
We'd probably do pretty well together.
You could go to therapy together.
Exactly.
So just out of curiosity, so we don't bury the lead there, do we still get to have Teflon pans?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
Did they ban the Teflon pans?
Yes, they actually, believe it or not,
okay,
they listened to me for about 5 minutes, but they wouldn't close the vote. And there was a Democrat running around the room telling everybody they had to vote yes. And they ultimately voted yes and banned the PFAS or you know, the Teflon pans.
Wow. Okay. Huh. So much for, you know, so much for that.
Yeah.
things you can't explain.
Are they banning vitamin D now?
Yeah, right. Yeah, stay out of the sun.
Exactly.
It's bad for you.
Yeah.
Okay, so if science can't help us and logic is dead, honestly, and the legislature... So at this point, we tuned in with you in December, but you guys started working to try to raise the profile of the coming gas shortage and the refineries closing and all that. You guys all started this, what, 6 months ago? Ish?
Oh, at least. Yeah, I mean, I've been working on it for at least 10 years in my career, but we came together, I'd say, 6-7 months ago as a team. Yeah.
And really started kind of pounding the airwaves, trying to get people to listen, and all of that. And so...
Because you know, you have a researcher in me, you have a practitioner in Mike, and a scientist in Stan, and you know, we know the math. I mean, we the math is the math, the data is the data, 2 and 2 equal 4 in our lives. You know, if Mike made a mistake in the refinery, it was a big mistake, right? He ran that refinery at a high level of precision and a high level of professionalism. He knows what valves to turn and what buttons to push. Stan and I are math guys. We understand the arithmetic and the math and the science behind it. And we began putting our numbers together and our heads together. And we said, you know, this is really actually worse than it looks. It really is.
Yeah, that was the thing. What caught my attention initially, you know, because I'm a farmer and everybody knows I work at Chico State. I'm an operating engineer there. But what caught me was when I heard Phillips 66 was shutting down, and I'm just doing my thing, you know, running my life, thinking that's not good. Prices are already high enough. But then when I heard Valero was shutting down, had decided to shut down. That's the most efficient, advanced refinery in the state. The one I control. I mean, I ran a couple others, but the Valero was the one I ran the most. It just caught me. I'm like, what the heck is going on? Why is Valero closing? What has been going on? So I started digging in and finding out and generated my own brief. I went down to the Capitol, took a day vacation, which I'd never done before in my life, and then, you know, that's how I ended up meeting Stan. But together we have learned so much from each other about the entire big picture. You know, there's 130 years of combined industry experience between the three of us. And it's like Professor pointed out, the researcher. I mean, I flew the plane. Stan's a scientist. We learned so much from each other. And like the professor just said, together we found out this is a hell of a lot worse than what it is. And people have no idea what's coming and what's going to hit them. And they're going to be standing around just going crazy.
Is there anyone else in the legislature at all or in, how about this? I don't care if they're in the legislature, in a position to do something about it, who has kind of joined on your with your cause and is looking for solutions or looking to press for that? Do you have others that are coming along?
From a legislative side, the Republicans are all on board. They'll help. There are some Dems, but they don't want to come out. So I've argued with them and debated with them, and they agree that they won't fight the status quo. So from a legislative side, no.
Okay, so no help coming there.
Nope. No, it's interesting, Aaron. If I can add to what Stan said, I'll have legislators come up to me, and it happened last Wednesday, and you know, they're Democrats, and they'll say, Professor, we have a lot of respect for the work that you're doing and your co-authors are doing. We get it. We understand the data's there. We understand the data's valid. And I'll say, well, thank you. And so can you speak out on it? No, I can't. If I speak out on this, I'll lose my privileges. I won't be appointed to the committees I want to be on. I will even lose my parking spot. And at the point where they're like, I can't do it. I don't want to lose my parking spot in the Capitol building. And unfortunately, that's where we're at. So it's difficult no matter how valid our arguments are and no matter how valid the data is, that, you know, it's come to that of political retribution or retaliation if somebody takes a contrary position, you know, to the party line at this point. I think the last, you know, one of the more defining points I think that's worth making here is what are Californians getting for what they're paying for CARB and for the CEC? You know, what are the budgets of those two agencies and what are the true results of those agencies? To what extent are Californians truly benefiting from their work? Because honestly, I know they've done good work. All right, but in this instance, they should have been on this years ago.
Yeah.
Years ago.
Yeah, because this didn't just happen. This obviously is a long, slow policy burn.
And unfortunately, it'll be a long, slow process to turn it around once it takes effect. I mean, we can't.
You can't have a long. Okay. All right. Could, if it takes as long to turn it around as it did to get us here, are we cooking over a fire at home?
Well, yeah. To a certain extent, okay. But here's what will happen. If indeed these prices go to the levels that some of us think they could go, okay. Or if you, and certainly if you have a significant disruption in the supply chain or a major geopolitical event in the Pacific, they will explode out of the roof. Plus, you've got pressure coming from Nevada. They have no,
they have no option.
They don't have a port. They got nothing, right? So you got to figure that President Trump is fully aware of this. He's on it. As a matter of fact, I know he's on it. And I think that at some point when the prices reach a threshold, you know, the hope for Californians would be federal intervention, because it's pretty clear that the state is incapable of addressing it on its own. So, and I think that's what may be in our cards, and that's what I mentioned in our presentation of February 11th. If the state doesn't step up and take action now to really address this and alleviate it and figure out how to do something, then the federal government will step in. And then California will lose pretty much a lot of the control, which they've already done. If you think about it, California has abdicated its control to foreign governments right now for gasoline and oil. So if CARB thinks or the CEC thinks they're going to dictate prices to China, good luck.
Oh, yeah, we're definitely not in a bargaining position. We're in a position of take what you can get.
It's at the mercy of. Not bargaining, at the mercy of, like the professor's saying. You're beholden to them.
Yeah.
And our military.
Can you imagine? Yeah. Our military is at the mercy of the Chinese sending us fuel. I mean, you can't even make that up.
No, you can't. You know, hello, China. Can you send us some fuel so we can defend Taiwan, please?
Yeah. Or defend against you. Right?
I mean, that's
defending against them. Yeah.
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 Yeah. So we can keep you from coming and taking over. Like.
Yeah. For example, right, the greenhouse gas emissions coming from Iraq, which is the number one supplier of oil to California, are 10 times greater than those that occur off of California's offshore refineries. 10 times greater. Now, California also gets a lot of fuel from Brazil. So Brazil is the number two provider of crude oil to California and the number one provider of, guess what, ethanol to California.
Mm.
Well, two things come into play here. One, to make ethanol, you need sugarcane. Brazil has burned 24 million acres of rainforest for sugarcane production, which is used for ethanol, most of which is consumed by Brazil, but is also exported to California. Secondly, Brazil's offshore oil production, Brazil's oil production, is almost entirely offshore. So California is willing to take offshore oil production from Brazil, put it on a tanker, bring it through the Panama Canal, bring it up the coast, and park it outside of L.A. or San Francisco for a number of days so it'd be offloaded, versus taking oil from Santa Barbara Channel. It's preposterous.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make sense.
When we come back, let's talk about the production that's available here in the state of California. I don't think people realize how much oil's under the ground here.
Happy to.
Let's hit that when we return. Okay, Bill, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, so you're listening to We the People Radio, but this particular topic, you can get to it swiftly at gascrisis.org. Org. Winning.
Winning.
What shall we do about them? When they move into your neighborhood, they take over, but good. They want you all body and soul. It's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them?
Too many lives they spend across the ocean. Too much money they spend upon the moon. Well, until they make it right, I hope they never sleep at night. They better make some changes and do it soon.
Yeah, really soon.
Oh, they're making changes.
Just the wrong ones.
Yeah.
All right. So we don't need to bring in oil from overseas or Brazil or through the Panama Canal or from outer space. We have a ton of it in the state of California under the ground, correct?
That is correct.
Yes, that's correct. But I mean, we will have to import oil because our consumption is much higher than our production. But we have a ton of oil under the ground. And as James Rector from Berkeley will tell you, California is very unique. He's a geophysicist. And so Professor Rector will say that California, as we are standing or sitting today, is making oil 20 to 25,000 feet below the surface. Oil is being constantly created in California, and because there's so much oil being created subsurface, it seeps to the top. These are called oil seeps, so it's forced up through the fissures, and it occurs all over the place. So, you know, in Los Angeles, we know it as the La Brea Tar Pit. So when you bring the little third graders to the La Brea Tar Pit to see, you know, the bones of dinosaurs, they're standing right next to greenhouse gas emissions, coming from naturally occurring seeps. And we have this off the coast of Santa Barbara. So very interesting. So we have an abundance of oil, an abundance.
And how much of it, I know maybe there's not a specific number, but how much of it are we actually making use of versus bringing it from somewhere else because it's icky and dirty and we don't want to use our own.
We're importing about 67% of the oil is coming from non-foreign producers. Non-U.S. foreign producers. So we're about 23%, and then of our own use comes from California. We import three times that amount from foreign producers, and we're getting a little bit from Alaska now, but not much. So we're getting more and more oil and now gasoline from non-U.S. foreign producers, when in fact we have a lot of oil under our feet. But as Mike Ariza pointed out, you can have a lot of oil, but if you don't have a refiner to sell it to, nobody's going to produce the oil. And we've lost refineries. So we're sort of in this death spiral.
Yeah. So we have
kind of to add to that.
Yeah.
I want to add to that. California is, in as far as oil reserves, is fifth in the nation in the United States behind Texas, North Dakota, a couple others. And then Kern County itself is the fifth largest oil-producing county in the nation. We have the reserves. So nobody can tell us we don't have the reserve. But to Mike's point, or Professor's point, if you don't have any refineries, what are we going to do?
Right, you have that problem, right? And so here's the thought process. I think what Gavin Newsom and some of the members of the legislature will do is they're going to say the following: gee, we gave you SB 237 and 2,000 permits a year to increase oil production. And we also gave you AB 30, which is ethanol, that we've said is going to bring the price down by 20 cents a gallon. Well, not going to happen. That's wishful thinking. And walk away from it. When in fact, AB 30 is not going to really help. And AB 237, which is great, we need more production out of Kern, but Kern itself will not compensate for what we need, given the demand strains on production.
And so for people who aren't following this close enough, so Assembly Bill 237 did what, or attempted to do what?
So 237 allowed... Go ahead.
Go ahead, Stan. That was one of your bills. Go ahead, buddy.
Yeah. Well, so what happened is it was a Democratic-authored bill to give a stipend to Kern County that already had the EIR, EIR impact studies already done, to drill 2,000 wells over the next 10 years. So if you take a well in Kern County and you drill, you're going to get 20, 30 barrels a day. Well, 30 barrels times 2,000 wells is 60,000 barrels. We're importing 1 million. We should be drilling thousands of wells, and we should unleash the beast in California and drill in every location like Ventura, L.A., Kern County. There's like five locations that we can get up to that, close to that 1 million barrels a day.
Right. Plus, if I might add, we have a ton of offshore oil. For example, one of the offshore producers is a company called Sable Offshore. They're in the Santa Barbara Channel. Well, they can produce anywhere from 40 to 50,000 barrels a day of oil. Plus, they have about 350,000 pretreated oil in storage tanks right now that they could add to the California system in a matter of days. But of course, there's issues, environmental restrictions applied to the pipeline and a bunch of lawsuits applied to that. So we're not a beneficiary of that production yet. That'll go through a number of court cases, and we expect a resolution, I think, relatively quickly in the month of March. The irony of it is Sable can't produce that oil and bring it onshore to the California refineries. Then they're going to put it on a tanker that just unloaded Iraqi oil. They're going to put California oil on that tanker and bring that tanker to South Korea, make gasoline, and it'll be re-imported to California. So somewhere, somebody thinks that's a much better greenhouse gas emission profile than producing the oil here in California.
And it seems super efficient, too.
Oh, yeah. Keeping the tankers in business, and they like that. So I guess it's good for, it's good for the foreign carrier tanker. Remember, the tankers that are being used aren't owned by American companies. They're going to be owned by the Chinese, the Greeks, the Japanese, and Iraqis.
Wow.
That's who owns the tank.
And so are they just hoping that people don't ever really learn about this? I mean, are they just counting on no blowback because people are just completely clueless?
Well, I'm waiting for Pat. Go ahead, Mike.
Stan's going to have a a different perspective on this than me, but I think you got it. The issue in California is, well, it's just part of the process. You know, when you look at the typical voter, we have the, you know, we have the second highest gasoline, well, the highest gasoline prices of the lower 48, the second highest utility costs, the first or second highest tax rates. And I just think people are just so conditioned to it that they sort of throw their hands up and just figure out a way of living with it. When in fact, they should be asking themselves, does this make sense? And I think that's a problem that we have in our state.
Yeah, problem is,
well, Skinner would call it operant conditioning. When you ring the bell, the dogs begin to salivate, right?
Yeah. And
it's already affecting people. It's affecting farmers up here already. Katie just wrote an article from some farmers I know in Durham, California, where the red dye diesel is starting to climb, and a couple of the farmers sent me their projected diesel use. You know, a small walnut farmer uses about $43,000, 26.6 gallons a day in his operation. Their operations, you know, $43,000 in a year on diesel, and yeah, I can potentially go to $60,000, $70,000, $80,000. And these aren't big corporations; these are small families trying to make it. They're already seeing the effects. They've already started to see the effects up here.
So I would tell you that, you know, several things have to happen for this crisis. You know, there's got to be a conflict somewhere, some bad weather, a couple of refineries shut down, or another one leave. There's some things that the problem with the president, California administration, their solution is to import more gas and diesel. That's not a solution. That's just delaying the inevitable. So I told my family that I felt like we should start stocking up on some groceries. We should be a little more conservative in our thought process. And back to the political question you asked, you know, until I ran for state assembly, I'd get my ballot in the mail. I go, what's this? Oh, what's this? What's this? I don't understand this. I'll call Shannon Grove. She'll tell me. So To the professor's point, most Californians can't even understand their ballot because they make it so damn sophisticated you can't.
Yeah.
Well, and they'll word it a way that, oh, well, that sounds good, but it's not good. And,
right.
And so we're caught. I'm really, that was a really good point, by the way, on our, I agree with you, Professor, that we do have a society that does not understand, because I didn't. I was in that same boat.
Well, I think sometimes we have fallen into that thing of you know, life sucks and then you die, right? We can't make the change, nothing's going to get fixed, and I constantly tell people, I'm like, ladies and gentlemen, these people are not electing each other, and they don't elect themselves. Like their constituents are sending them there. They are us.
That's right.
They are us.
No, it's super interesting. I lived in California for a long. This is my third time in California, right? So I was born.
You're a recidivist.
Right. I was born overseas, right? And I entered the state as an infant in San Francisco, off of a boat in my mom's arms, and then I came back to California around 1980. And the 80s were an incredible decade for our state, just a fantastic decade. And then I came back in 97 to teach for USD, and I noticed a distinct change in the climate of the state and sort of the attitude of the state, and honestly, sort of a degradation of sort of an interest in things and kind of, I don't want to say an apathy, but just what can I do about it other than I have to accept it and get on? And now what we're saying is, if I don't want to accept it and I can, I move out. I mean, what? Mark Zuckerberg just left the state last week, I read. Sylvester Stallone. So, you know, not only companies are fleeing the state, like Oracle and guess what, Chevron, but also now high profile individuals who can't afford to leave the state are leaving the state. So it would seem to me, if I were a policymaker, to be paying a lot of attention to that. I'd be asking these companies, why are you leaving? And these individuals, why are you leaving? And they're going to tell you cost of living, policies, taxes, and just a difficult time to live in California right now. And I think until sort of the rest of us kind of feel that way, we're going to be stuck with take it or leave it because I'm smarter than you type legislation.
Yeah, they have
to
look
at... We just let that hang there for a second.
Well, they have to look at how many companies have left this state, and this isn't just recently. This is...
No, remember the guy we interviewed like 8 years ago, and he was his business was helping companies relocate in or out of the state. He lived in California, and he was that was his industry, was helping large companies move around. And he said, "Oh yeah, they're leaving in droves." And it was probably 2 years after that I called him to do an interview. Yeah, he was gone too.
Yeah.
He helped a whole bunch of them move out, and then it was like, see ya.
Well, gosh, I mean, I remember when PayPal moved out of California. It was a big deal. That was...
Oh, my gosh, that was a long time ago.
15 years ago, and, you know, that was a lot of jobs right in the heart of Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
And it's just continued. I don't know how many big companies are left.
Oh, my gosh, we only have 12 seconds? What's wrong with us?
Yep.
Seven seconds? We'll just count it down.
We're out of time.
Bye, you guys. Thanks a lot. 1 second. We the People Radio. Bye.
We gotta get out of this place. If it's the last thing we ever do, we gotta get out of this place. Girl, there's a better life for me and you. Somewhere, baby. Somehow.